In the month in which we celebrate the 140th anniversary of the opening of its central pier, what better place to visit to soak up the wonderful entertainment heritage of these iconic seaside structures than Britain's top resort, Blackpool? Blackpool has never done anything by halves, and that's certainly true of its piers. Where most resorts may do with one or maybe two, Blackpool built three in 30 years. The North Pier opened in 1863, the Central Pier in 1868, and the upmarket Victoria or South Pier in 1893. But the story of Britain's piers begins on the south coast of England. Professor Fred Gray of the University of Sussex.
The pier really starts in the early 19th century. One of the best and most well-known early piers was the Chain Pier in Brighton. That was opened in 1823, eventually blew down in 1896. The interesting thing about piers, those early piers, though, is that they almost all start off simply as landing stages. People travelled to the seaside by boat, mostly, until the coming of the railways in the 1840s. So they were landing stages. And the interesting thing is that the people who owned piers quickly realised that holidaymakers, visitors to seaside towns, actually liked walking on piers. So it wasn't simply a landing stage, but the piers also became promenade spaces. Actually, the owners of piers could charge people to walk over water, walk on a pier. And so they start off as landing stages and very quickly become promenades as well, very select promenades because they were being charged for. And then little bits of entertainment get added. There'd be perhaps a little band, open-air band, there'd be a bazaar, and so on. So bits of entertainment get added to it.
This commercialisation of piers was encouraged by engineering advances throughout the 19th century. The bigger they got, the more attractions they could host.
There's a wonderful invention called the screw pile, which meant that you could actually literally screw wrought iron or cast iron piles down into the seabed. And that meant that, in theory, you could build piers of much greater length and also much greater width. At the same time, holidaymaking changes as well, and more middle class and then working class people come down to the seaside, carried there by the train. Pier owners realise that rather than just this promenade, actually, if they put big buildings on piers, pack them out with indoor and outdoor entertainments, then actually people will both pay money to get onto the piers, but also pay money to take part and watch and enjoy the entertainments on the piers.
The end of the pier show was born.
Piers, of course, were in competition with often larger entertainment buildings, and in the case of Blackpool, you know, the Winter Gardens, the Tower and so on, lots of other entertainment buildings there, and so the piers had to compete with that. And so by the 1900, which was really the last sort of decade of pier building on any large scale, Britain had 100-odd piers, and most of them had big entertainment buildings on them as well.
And these buildings added to the fun and sense of escape that resorts like Blackpool offered. Fred Gray.
Architecturally, they were often distinctive. Some of them had wonderful Oriental, what's called Oriental architecture, very ornate domed architecture, hinting at other places, other times. That was true of the North Pier in Blackpool. It was true of the West Pier in Brighton. It was true of Morecambe Pier, Morecambe Central Pier. So lots of those pier buildings were very ornate, ornamental buildings. And that added to that experience, I think, of going to somewhere special. There's wonderful photographs, wonderful film of some of the Blackpool piers totally covered in people. So it's difficult to actually see the pier. There's just heads and heads and heads of people. And if you try to conjure up what that must have been like, the sweatiness of it, the thrusting bodies, the smell of it, you know, lots and lots of people would smoke as well. So, you know, great heaving places of entertainment and really great.
But as well as the shows and the dancers, the piers and the beaches around them offered visitors another type of al fresco entertainment.
For admission all classes, I shall be performing as the Reverend Uncle Taco with my Piero troupe, the Pier Otters, which is the last remaining professional seaside Piero troupe in the whole of Britain.
Tony Lidington.
The character of Piero comes from the Commedia dell'arte, which is the Italian comedy, which is a medieval form of itinerant travelling performance. The characters there were divided into various groups, one of which were the peasant characters, or Zanni, as they were known, where we get the word zany from. And one of those characters was Pedrolino, and he had long white sleeves and was the unrequited lover in one of the stock characters of the Italian comedy. And then, during the 18th century, what became Pierrots moved into France and opera bouffe, and that's where we get the familiar figure of Jean-Louis Barrault from Les Enfants du Paradis, which is the wide baggy clothes and the black tight skull cap and a lot of mime and kind of type of thing people associate with Marcel, I suppose. And that silent form came across to England in 1890. There was a production called L'Enfant Prodigue, which was seen by a man called Clifford Essex. And he was somebody who'd been a society entertainer using the banjo principally. And he decided to dress his entertainers as Pierrots.
And it was the look that Essex came up with which defined the impact of these wandering troops.
The early Pierrots used makeup more than the later ones. So they had quite blanched faces, not heavy clown white, but kind of powdered down. And they would accentuate their eyebrows and their lips, so they looked really quite effeminate. They never had a tear. That didn't exist. But they would have flowing costumes made of silk or satin, ruffles around their neck, which would often be contrasting by being black and white. They'd have a black skull cap that would be tied around their head, made of silk or a very light cotton. And then on top of that, they'd have the white conical hat, usually with a pom-pom on that as well. The Pierrots always had to look immaculate, partly because they had to be perceived as being available. They were like a boy band. Most of them, the early Pierrots, were male. Not all, but most. And they weren't allowed to greet girlfriends in public. They weren't allowed to be seen to be married and kiss somebody. They would be paraded through the town. They would greet people off the trains. In their performances, there's no lighting, there's no difference between the stage and the audience other than kind of 6 inches of decking, perhaps, and quite often not even that. It'd just be a roped-off area with deck chairs. So in that sense, it's very direct as a Punch and Judy or a circus show. And that's where its roots, of course, are, which is that style of popular entertainment. They all have similar kinds of roots, and in my theory, if you like, is that the British popular entertainment forms all stem from roughly the same period, which is the kind of late Georgian times, and then became independent of European or American or more international influences because of the dominance of empire, the dominance of English culture being sent out rather than absorbing things in, and of course the terror of anything from the continent because of the Napoleonic Wars.
The Pierrot troops started to disappear as the seaside became less popular during and after the Second World War, and people turned to radio and television for their entertainment. Which is rather ironic, according to Tony Liddington.
You can't look at British music or British humour without acknowledging the role that Concert Party and Pierrot troops had in the development of what we now call mass media. All the physical comedy that had been preserved in pantomime that then got sold back to us through American silent films, and a lot of verbal humour that again had been part and parcel of Victorian clowning in a circus, actually found its outing on the halls, which was obviously indoors, and the development of the halls. But as the halls got bigger and bigger and bigger, and they were getting bigger and bigger stars, there were other outlets needed, and the seaside, it was al fresco, and so in the terms of engagement, it was a lot cheaper to employ people, and it was a ready audience.
If the Pierrots started to disappear after the Second World War, when did the end of the pier show begin to make way for the amusement arcades and fairground rides that we associate piers with today? Professor Fred Gray.
It's an interesting question. I always thought it was really the 1930s, but in fact you can trace it back earlier than that. So the first mutoscopes, the first What the Butler Saw machines, get onto piers in the late 19th century. So even then there was some popular entertainment. So I think that the central pier in Blackpool had a railway grotto on it by about 1908. So there was just the start of what I think of as fairground amusement park attractions on piers from the early 20th century. But it's not really until the 1930s, and actually not really until the 1950s, that many, many piers adopt a very big fun fair amusement park approach to entertainment. And by that time, many of the peer entertainments of variety shows, of music hall and so on, were starting to fade.
But for just one weekend this May, you can relive the heyday of the British seaside pier and the entertainment that they provided when Admission All Classes pays tribute to the End of the Pier show. More details on the website.